joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. After the 2008 financial meltdown, pundits predicted conservatives would have to move to the center or face irrelevance. But instead, Republicans retook the House of Representatives in 2010 in the biggest midterm victory since 1938. In his new book titled Pity the Billionaire, Thomas Frank argues that the American right pulled off a hard time swindle, casting themselves as the champion of the common man. Tom Frank joins me in the studio. You can join us as well, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. It's good to see you.
It is my pleasure to be here, Diane.
You were a Wall Street Journal columnist during the 2008 financial meltdown. You felt the country was really almost sliding into some kind of deep depression. Is that what led you now to write this book?
Yeah, in some ways it is. This is going to sound really strange to your readers, but all my life I've been really interested in the literature of the 1930s, the Great Depression. One of my heroes is Edmund Wilson, who was the literary critic for the New Republic at the time and wrote a famous series of essays about protest movements in America in the 1930s. And when I saw these things happening, the financial crisis, I mean, that looked like right out of 1929. And everybody thought at the time that the great sort of left turn of 1932 was at hand. And I myself wanted to go out and do the kind of thing that Edmund Wilson did in his Depression essays. I wanted to see the protest movements with my own eyes. I wanted to, you know, listen to people who were losing their faith in, you know, the old order, as you know, as we used to say back in those days. And so that's how I happened to be at the first Tea Party protest in February of 2009. And what I saw there was, on the surface, exactly like what Edmund Wilson wrote about back in those days. But the politics of it were completely the reverse, completely the reverse. And it just went from victory to victory to victory, to the point that you mentioned in the introduction of their great sweeping victory of 2010. And now look at, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina.
How do you think they did it?
Well, whether it was planned or not, but first, I think the first step that we have to look at is the perversity of the accomplishment. I mean, it's an amazing thing that they did, for the simple reason that you had this financial crisis that really was the result of many years of sort of bipartisan consensus economic policy about deregulation. And this is something that virtually every account of the financial crisis and the shadow banking sector and the predatory lending and, you know, all the mortgage originators, all that stuff. You go back and read that literature, and I did, and it's a wonderful body of work. But you can see how this was made possible by the deregulatory laissez-faire philosophy. And we have never seen, aside from, say, the collapse of the Soviet Union, we've never seen a more ideologically determined failure than that financial crisis in 2008. And I thought when that was – I mean, how can you have a political movement that comes around and embraces that very – the philosophy that led to that as the solution to the times that we're in? And that's what's happened.
But I think your thesis is that the working class themselves bought into this and helped – the rise of the Tea Party.
Well, we know statistically that is true. Now, this is actually a more involved story than that, but that is, yes, that's, I mean, the obviously you can't win elections in this country if you don't have working class people voting for you, and we know that that's what happened in places like Wisconsin, where you had this huge shift in working class loyalty from the Democrats to the Republicans. Now, this is, truth be told, been going on for a long time, and I've been writing about it for a long time. But it accelerated. You know, what is the famous the line Hemingway's line about people going bankrupt? Just, you know, first slowly and then all of a sudden, and that's what happened. You know, to the Democrats. But if you examine the Tea Party movement closely and hang around with them, it's not really a working class movement. It looks like one. It talks like one. But the people who are out there in the parks waving those signs are not, you know, blue collar guys from the local steel mill. That's not who they are. I'll tell you a funny story. I went to a Tea Party rally in Denver, and I met a man who had chosen to show up at this protest rally wearing an ascot. Okay. Now, that's not something that you see very frequently. Even here in Washington, D.C., that's fairly unusual. In fact, I'd never seen that ever before.
Did a fair number of wealthy people go in to help this Tea Party movement get started?
Well, absolutely. This is the beginnings of the Tea Party movement are, you know, it's criticized a lot for being phony grassroots. The term they use is astroturf, and I think that's pretty accurate. That's what it was in the beginning. That first one that I described, the one that I went to in February of 2009 here in D.C., and it had been organized by various pillars of the conservative establishment here in the city, you know, magazines, think tanks. And there are several organizations behind it that are funded by the Koch brothers, my fellow Kansans from Wichita. They're oil billionaires. They have a lot of, and they've been funding conservative projects for a long time, or I guess they would say libertarian projects, to make this seem, to just heighten the perversity and strangeness of it. The whole thing was basically called into being from the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. Do you remember the famous Rick Santelli rant? I don't know if you remember this, but he is a CNBC financial news reporter, and his beat is the commodities exchange in Chicago. And one day, this was during the bailouts in the early part of 2009, he was very angry about the bailouts, as we all were. And he started yelling at the camera, and it went on this very eloquent tirade about, angry at the bailouts. And he was being cheered by the derivatives traders on the floor around him. And it went viral, as they used to say, and people were watching it on YouTube, this clip of Rick Santelli. And in his rant, he said we should have a Boston Tea Party, or I think he said we should have a Chicago Tea Party to show our anger about these things. And that's where the phrase came from. But the fact I want to highlight here is that and it sounds very populist. All of this stuff is very populist. But like I mentioned earlier that I'm from Kansas. Populism was a big deal in Kansas a long time ago. And in the great sort of populist worldview, the Chicago Board of Trade was the very focus of evil in the universe. You know, this is where, you know, these parasites who produced nothing, who made nothing, would rip off the farmer on one side and the consumer on the other side. Populists hated the Chicago Board of Trade. Here you have a populist movement in our own day, a populist movement being called into being from the very floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. I always loved that little irony.
But why couldn't Democrats do their own successful populist uprising?
Oh, wow. Well, Diane, that's the big question. I mean, I've been wondering about that all my life, because this isn't the first populist revolt on the right. This has been going on since the days of Nixon, when, what did he call it, the silent majority. And you've had one after another. You had the culture wars. You had the new right in the 1970s. You had the Gingrich Revolution. All of these had a populist flavor to them. The culture wars, very populist. And the Democrats never seem to be able to respond in kind. And it's extremely frustrating to me, both as a liberal, I'm pretty liberal, and as somebody that wants to see a good ball game, you know? I want to see I want to see a good fight here.
I think it's also that the Democrats have never had the wordsmiths that the extreme right has or the right has. I think about Frank Luntz. I mean, you talk about silent majority. Now, where does that go back to? It goes back to Agnew and Nixon. You talk about the way Democrats are described now. There are words that are being used that are so potent as to make the entire Democratic Party seem worthless.
You're absolutely correct in that regard. But you know, there are plenty of people out there who on both sides who are equally smart. And I think of, you know, I always go back to Franklin Roosevelt. There's a wordsmith for you. I mean, the phrases that he came up with.
Yeah.
What's funny? You're absolutely right. Here's a way of getting at that. The conservative movement is much better organized. It's more concentrated. They come out of the conservatives tend to come out of the business community, so they're very good at organization and at the sort of public relations skills. None of that is a surprise. What is interesting to me is the sort of larger cultural aversion that Democrats have to populism. I'll give you an example. Back in the 70s, I mentioned in passing the New Right. Well, the New Right had a slogan. I've always loved this. Their slogan was one of many slogans, organized discontent. I like that. They would organize discontent. And this is, of course, a slogan that they stole from the left, as with many of the things that we're going to be talking about in this hour were swiped from the historical left, like the IWW or the labor movement. Okay, organized discontent. And they'd be out there doing that, making people angry, getting angry people together, you know. The bitter, self-made men of America coming together, you know, in fury against, you know, the Washington elites, as they love to say, or the nattering nabobs of negativism. You mentioned Agnew. And the Democrats on the other side, for their part, are very uncomfortable with organizing discontent. Now, they know in the back of their minds that that's where their party comes from. That's, you know, you wouldn't have a Democratic Party if it wasn't for, you know, the discontent in the 1930s.
And as for the nattering nabobs, let us not forget Bill Sapphire. And short break and right back. Welcome back. Thomas Frank is with me. He, of course, wrote the best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Now he's got a new one. It's titled Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Go to that phrase, the hard time swindle, and exactly what you're saying.
It's like a game of three-card Monty, okay? The nation is upset at the end of the financial crisis, furious. I mean, we're watching the economy slide into what looks like Great Depression 2. And this, you know, it's like our anger doesn't have a direction. And the conservative movement got out ahead of that anger and said, you know, you're angry at Wall Street. No, 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 no. You're angry at these guys over here.
At the government.
Government. You know, and so our anger was shifted from one target to another.
How?
Well, the bailouts, I think. The bailouts were the big that was the turning point. I'll tell you, take a step back here. You mentioned that I was a Wall Street Journal columnist at the time of the financial crisis. I was. I was the liberal voice on their op-ed page, a regular liberal columnist there. And I tried my best to understand what was going on with the financial crisis. And I remember to this day how extremely hard it was for me to figure out what a credit default swap was, you know?
Me too.
Yes. The financial crisis was really hard to understand, but the bailouts were very easy to understand. Yeah. This was an obscenity, an outrage. And it was everybody across the political spectrum regarded it as such that our tax money should be used to prop up the bad guys, the guys that did this, that ran
How
us over the cliff.
How did that happen?
Well, you have to, I mean, you mean technically or politically or?
Politically. How did that happen?
It doesn't surprise me that, you know, Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time, rode to the rescue of Wall Street banks. He was from Wall Street himself, and that I'm sure made sense to him, not only in an intellectual way that you have to keep it liquid, you have to provide liquidity, right? That's sort of the slogan, that was the mantra at the time, but it was also those were his friends, and I I don't want to say that it was
not saying that he felt it was more important to save his friends than save the country.
I think I'm sure he thought he was doing both. But it wasn't just him, of course. This is across the board. The Federal Reserve had signed was bailing out with both hands. let us not forget. And they were doing all this before Congress had authorized it. Congress finally weighed in with the TARP, and you've got plenty of friends of Wall Street in Congress as well. You know, what did Dick Durbin say? The banks own this place. You know, but it wasn't just an act of pure cold corruption. They thought they were doing the right thing. Now, what I feel to be the great political mistake in all this is that when President Obama came in, he chose to continue that policy with almost no changes. He brought in fact, Tim Geithner who had been the head of the New York Fed, had been the point man in the bailouts, made him the new Treasury Secretary, you know, kept Bernanke on at the Fed, and announced, you know, in this spirit of bipartisanship, this is going to continue, the spirit of, we want to, you know, do the statesmanlike thing. And that he owned it. That made it his. And that made him fair game for the right. And they've ridden that thing ever since. Now, the point that I always make when I'm talking about this is that there's more than one way to do a bailout. There's more than one way to rescue a financial sector in distress. And in fact, you don't even need to rescue the institutions. You take something like Citibank or any of these other too big to fail institutions. You know, that whole idea of too big to fail should have been massively discredited by all this. Why not unwind these banks in an orderly manner, as the FDIC does with banks every day of the week? You know, all across this country, they do it all the time. We know how it's done.
Who designed the phrase too big to fail?
I actually know something about this, Diane. That phrase comes from in the 1980s. It was they were talking about Continental Illinois Bank, which was one of the biggest bank failure in U.S. history at the time and was bailed out by the Reagan administration. And this is this is an inconvenient piece of knowledge the paladin of the free market way, Ronald Reagan, and his administration was bailing out banks as well. And over the years, that phrase sort of caught on. And once upon a time, people thought that was a good thing. A bank being too big to fail. But it's a reprehensible thing, as we know now.
And what about Lehman Brothers? Had it not gone down, what would have been the difference?
That's anybody's guess. The question people usually ask is, should we have just let the others go down? Should we have let AIG go? And then once AIG had gone, you know, it would have taken everybody with it. And the answer to that is, I mean, of course, you couldn't just allow financial Armageddon to happen. You had to do something. Absolutely, you had to do something. But did you have to pay AIG's creditors 100 cents on the dollar? No, certainly not. There's the point is this. There's lots of different ways to do a bailout, okay? And we know this from the days of the Hoover and Roosevelt administration. They both bailed out banks, but they did it in two very, very different ways. But it's as though those choices were off the table this time. They were unknown to us.
So what you're saying is that the anger about all of that turned into anger at the government.
Exactly.
And that is how the Republicans won.
Yes.
The 2010 election.
By making, and this is the point that just, this is the thing that really just blows my mind every time they think about it. So when I saw something like that going on, the bailouts, I was like, you know, it's cronyism. It's lobbyists. It's all the things that we've been talking about for, you know, 20 years, the power of industry over the regulators. But when the right looks at that, they say, this is government meddling. The obvious answer is not to retreat from our commitment to deregulation, not to retreat from what we've been doing for the last 30 years, but to go so much further, to double down on it, you know, and to just get government out of the picture altogether. That's the only way out of this, is
get
by going to
rid of regulation.
That's right. And they're all saying this right now. They're out on the campaign trail. The Republican candidate's swearing. You know, well, you know, my rival here says he's going to overturn, you know, most of the Obama regulations, new bank regulations. Well, I'm going to overturn all of them, and then I'm going to overturn even more. They're trying to one-up one another on this, that we've got to completely dismantle or largely dismantle the regulatory state, which is an amazing response when you think about it to a crisis brought on by deregulation.
But they must feel as though the public is with them. You hear people echo those words constantly. Well, the government is regulating too much.
That's right. And the argument also goes that you can't say that free market capitalism failed because it was never tried, which is a very interesting phrase. That's something that you used to hear from socialists, right? You can't say that socialism failed. It was never tried. The Soviet Union was, you know, imperfect, and you know, it was this horrible, monstrous dictatorship, and all, you know, that argument, and that should clue you into a really eerie similarity. These are both utopian philosophies, and this is sort of how Pity the Billionaire concludes. The second to last chapter is about the free market faith as a kind of utopia, as a kind of idealism, but an idealism so powerful that it is capable of, and I'm trying to think of a way to put this that's not insulting or stupid, but it's capable of clouding the minds of its followers in the same way that people on the left were, say, in the 1930s, were capable of overlooking the crimes of the Soviet Union, things that everybody else could see, that anybody that read a newspaper knew about. But people on the left were like, you know, no, 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 you know, completely disregarded it, you know, thought it was all propaganda. And this is sort of what you see on the right today.
Here's an email from Jennifer, who says in his earlier book, What's the Matter with Kansas, Mr. Frank insisted race was not relevant to the blue-collar support of the right-wing agenda. Of course, the book was published before the election of Mr. Obama. Is Mr. Frank still convinced that race is not a part of the reason for white working class hostility to moderate liberal political agenda?
I think that's probably a misunderstanding. The argument in What's the Matter with Kansas was that a lot of the right-wing populism began as pretty much straight-up racism in the 60s. I mean, the father of all this stuff was George Wallace. You know, he was the sort of great inventor of a lot of these themes that we've been following, all the culture war stuff. He really originated it. And remember, Richard Nixon swiped it from him. And this was, they called this the Southern Strategy. Do you remember this? And that really is where it came from. But my argument was that over the years, it became sort of secularized and the racism was drained out of it. And so today you have a movement that's saying the same things, but one of their heroes just about a month ago was Herman Cain, you know. So they're able to say these you know, these arguments, they're able to reiterate these themes that definitely had a racist beginning, but in service of, I think it's that racism is not as important today as it was then. Now, you know, I think that what motivates the people with this sort of extreme hostility to Barack Obama that you see, and I'm sure that that race is part of that equation, absolutely. But you know, when I'm writing about these people, I think it's only fair to the Tea Party movement and the other people that I write about to consider what they actually say rather than what I suspect they feel in their innermost heart of hearts. And yes, there are a handful of outrageous racist incidents, and I mentioned some of them in the book. But by and large, you know, 99% of what they talk about is not, is other things.
You profile Glenn Beck as one of the standard bearers of the hard time swindle. Why do you single him out?
Oh, he fascinates me. He's fascinating. Remember, he was on the cover of Time magazine. When was that? It was in 09. That was when his star was on the rise. And I thought he, more than anybody else, any other public figure at the time, captured the sensibility I'm talking about, speaking to this kind of hard times anger. I mean, he was really a man like me, I think, who's immersed in a lot of 30s culture, although he never says that. But he talks about it all the time. One of his heroes, as he says in his first book, is Orson Welles, you know, the great sort of boy genius of the 1930s. And Beck started something called the 9/12 Project. This was going to be his version of the Tea Party movement. And after I studied this and watched his TV shows announcing it and that sort of thing, and it suddenly dawned on me that this was basically lifted right out of a Frank Capra movie, Meet John Doe. it's similar in all these really curious ways. So anyhow, he's an interesting figure for me because he is very definitely speaking to the hard time sensibility. And, you know, people in the country were afraid, scared, you know, angry. And that was what he was all about. You know, he had been around on radio and TV before before the recession began, before the Great Recession started. But it was only when panic set in that he suddenly caught on.
Tom Franke's new book, Pity the Billionaire, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about Rush Limbaugh?
I talk about him as well, but he isn't as important to me. I mean, he doesn't have a TV show anymore. Well, neither does Glenn Beck, for that matter. But Rush Limbaugh is obviously a hugely important figure when you study the right, which I do. I'll tell you a funny story. So I had a friend, a newspaper, a fellow journalist from France, and he came over and he wanted to write about it. He wanted to write about America and its great shift to the right. And he would say, you know, I come over to your country every 4 years, and every 4 years it's moved further to the right, and I don't understand it. I want you to help me look into this. And so we drove all around West Virginia talking to people, and I made him listen to Rush Limbaugh constantly. And the car, I'll never forget this. We would drive over a mountain, and Rush Limbaugh's voice would fade out. The radio station would fade out, and he'd be like, "Oh, it's over." And I'd be like, "No." And I'd push the button to the next radio station, also playing Rush Limbaugh. And everywhere you go, everywhere you go in places like Kansas, Rush Limbaugh is this presence. You know, he's giving you the talking points. The local cafe will have a Rush room where the people get together and talk about the wonderful wisdom that they've heard on Rush Limbaugh. And there is no left-wing equivalent. There is no presence. The sort of my kind of critique of political economy does not have a presence in those small towns, in those West Virginia valleys. It doesn't exist. And that's very, very important.
All right. We've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Love your show, by the way, Diane.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say I feel like the problem is more than the right being more aggressive or successful. It's that the corruption is incredibly widespread between both parties. If you look at where the campaign money comes from, and if you look at... that's basically the gist of it. I mean, Obama, half his money came from the financial industry. It's just, we can't have an honest discussion without campaign finance reform.
Huh. Yeah, that's exactly right. And the campaign finance reform, that's, you know, I've been in favor of that for many, many, many years. But what the caller is saying is exactly right. But I wouldn't say – corruption, I think, is too strong a word. For these people, it's the word that you want, and Diane, you're here in D.C., it's consensus. This is, you know, everybody's all nice and polite here in Washington, D.C., and they all agree on everything. And one of the things they agree on is the sort of great, you know, the great turn towards markets that began in the 1980s. This is common sense for these people. And, you know, Barack Obama is actually was very open about this. There's a passage in his memoir, The Audacity of Hope. He's very frank, much more forthright than I've ever seen or than I've seen most Democrats be, where he talks about fundraising when he's running for the U.S. Senate seat from Illinois, and how he would meet with the kind of people who fund Democratic campaigns. And they tend to be very wealthy, you know, often in the financial sector, but they're liberal on social issues. But they have zero tolerance for organized labor. They believe in markets almost as, you know, not with the kind of, you know, utopian fervor that the Tea Party does, but they believe in them. And so the differences between them and the right on these sort of critical issues of financial regulation are not very great. That's absolutely true.
He could have made a big difference, do you think, in what happened after 2008?
President Obama?
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, he came into office as a kind of Roosevelt figure. You remember those crowds when he was inaugurated? I mean, there it was this, and he had both houses of Congress behind him and the nation behind him. He could have, I think he could have done anything he wanted.
Tom Frank. The book is Pity the Millionaire. Short break, and when we come back, more of your calls, your questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Rin Tin Tin, a dog found in the wreckage of a kennel during World War I, who would become one of film, radio, and television's biggest stars. We'll talk with author Susan Orlean about her new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's her first original book since her bestseller, The Orchid Thief. Join us.
And if you've just joined us, Thomas Frank is with me. Of course, he's the best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas? Now he's written a new one. It's titled Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. One essential element of the hard time swindle you talk about was the right's ability to manipulate class differences. How did they do it?
This is going to sound strange, but the conservative movement talks about class all the time. The you know, the phrase that they like to use is the ruling class. And I mean, they've talked about the liberal elite ever since I was a little kid. You know, the liberal elite, you know, is doing this. The liberal elite is doing that. But in the course of 2010, they came up with a new way of phrasing this. And this was a, you know, sort of instantly popular thing. The phrase was the ruling class. It was started as a article in National Review and then was published as a book and was an instant hit on the right. And it's kind of a version of sort of Marxism for the ruling class, you know, or what was a Hofstadter's phrase, the Marx of the master class. I love that. But it's a class critique that describes the you know, the present situation as a war between people who are educated and associated with Washington in some way, with government in some way, and then everybody else. And these are the two classes in America, and they're having it out in some, you know, titanic showdown that's going on right now. And this caught on with the right, and they started expressing this, especially the Tea Party movement, and they started expressing everything as, you know, it's a fight with the ruling class. And I remember Richard Viguerie, who's a sort of one of the great strategists. You talk about wordsmiths. Here's your man, one of the great thinkers and PR people of the conservative movement. And he had an election night watch party in 2010 called "Out with the Ruling Class." I love that. I mean,
Here's an email from Bob in Texas, who says, "My objection to government regulation is not that some regulation is not needed, but the fact that our government regulatory agencies are so inefficient and incompetent in applying regulations that, in fact, they do through mistakes, ineffectiveness, agency, and cronyism, they do more damage to the economy and the well-being of the general populace than good."
Well, I wouldn't agree with that last sentence, but all the rest of it is correct. I mean, and this is something, regulatory failure, something you see, you know, again and again and again and again. Okay, look at, I mean, how did all of this crazy stuff in the financial sector happen? And do you remember that famous photograph of the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision? One of those, I think, five bank financial regulators in America, and that was one of them. And he was meeting with a bunch of lobbyists, and they had all brought garden implements to show how they were going to cut red tape, right? And he brought a chainsaw, the head of the agency, with all these lobbyists. There's a phrase for this. It's regulatory capture, okay? But for some reason, even though we've had regulatory failure after regulatory failure, my liberal friends will not use that phrase. You'd look at what happened with the BP, the oil, you know, drilling platform in the Gulf. You know, another regulatory failure. The agency that was supposed to be overseeing that was partying with the oil drillers. You look at the guys that are supposed to supervise coal mining in this country. You have all those miners that died in West Virginia, and then it turns out that the company was totally able to pull the wool over the eyes of the regulators, easy as pie, right? Why do these things happen one after another after another? At least President Obama should tell us why, or give us a theory, give us some kind of explanation, because otherwise the sort of almost the natural conclusion that people come to is that it's impossible to regulate. You know, the whole thing is a fool's errand.
And here's a similar one from Nick, who says, "Mr. Frank clearly doesn't understand the situation that took place. The crisis wasn't brought on by deregulation. There were regulations in place. The SEC did not do their job, which caused more problems than a lack of regulation."
Absolutely. That's totally correct. But I would include under my term deregulation, which is sort of a catch-all for what's been going on, the term that I mean, the actual technical term for what happened is called desupervision. This is when you have the laws in place, you have the agency in place, and the laws aren't enforced. And that was going on all through the Bush years. In fact, that was strategy. That was what they did, that the Bush administration delivered desupervision to these guys.
So has the Obama administration not been able to break through?
In some ways they've tried, but you look, this is something that is a highly technical issue. This is something that the the banks themselves pay a lot of attention to, but the general public does not. The only way to win a fight like this, if you're a liberal like me, is to do like Franklin Roosevelt did and make a huge big deal out of it. You know, otherwise the public is not interested. I mean, these stories that were coming out of the SEC, you know, a few years ago about the guys having to make their photocopies down at Kinko's because they didn't have photocopiers in the offices of the SEC or they were broken, you know, and the lawyers had to do it themselves, had to go down there and stand in line. And they're, by the way, going up against, on the other side of the table from them, the best paid lawyers in the Western world, the Wall Street's lawyers.
And Frank wants to know, has Occupy Wall Street stolen back the misdirected anger of the hard time swindle?
Oh, I hope they have. But I'll tell you, I mean, you know, that would be – it would be wonderful. But this is just a – you know, they had a great sort of internet display, the I am the 99% thing, very powerful. I saw that and it – you know, I thought that was really overwhelming and very, very convincing and heartbreaking. But I don't know if – you know, they've got to move – beyond camping out in public places. You know, that's great for a start, and it drew a lot of attention to their cause, which is also, I think, my cause. But they've got to go much further. The Tea Party movement, the right, is so far along in their project. An example, I spent a lot of time, not a lot, but some time out in Wisconsin during the big anti-Scott Walker rallies, and I was very inspired by that, and I wrote about it for Harper's Magazine. But that was a cry of desperation. That was people whose backs are to the wall and who are looking at, the, you know, their way of life being destroyed. It is the start, you know, maybe, but it's, you know, it's a cry of desperation. It's got to become something much, much bigger than this. But with the Tea Party movement, you're looking at people who have basically been having their way politically for 30 years and now are saying, we've got to go all the way to this sort of utopia, this vision that we have, and we're close to achieving it. That's something very different.
All right. To Chris in Moosehead, Rhode Island. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, and that's Connecticut, Diane.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. One of the things, and a quick comment and a question. Here in Connecticut, the people that helped form the Tea Party were all racist, and they used fear. And what brought on this crisis were changes in laws that allowed things that brought on the Great Depression to happen again. Derivatives are nothing new. They happened in the 30s. You could... basically, like a casino, you could put a don't bet on stocks. The thing that gets me, and the problem with the president, is he's a company man. If he had got up and said, listen, we need to continue this, but these guys hoodwinked us. They didn't want this money to save the country. They wanted it for their bonuses. My sister lived next to a guy who got $1.3 million in a bonus, and his firm went bankrupt.
Yep, that's right. Bankruptcy for fun and profit. There's a friend of mine wrote a book called The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And I think we're seeing that borne out all the time. But the caller, you know, you should read this book, Pity the Billionaire. It's going to – it's exactly what you're talking about. Can I just pile on here a little bit with the critique of the Democrats and what they've done wrong? And one of the chapters of the book is called The Silence of the Technocrats. And the Democrats have their heart in the right place, in my view. There's a lot of good people in the Obama administration, a lot of people that I really admire. And I think a lot of the things that they did were exactly the right things. The stimulus, that was exactly right. Some version of national...
Needed more, a lot of
Oh, I thought they said... Yeah, that's right. I think they should have done it differently. Let's put it that way. They had the national... We had the big debate over national health care. That was exactly the right thing to do. But they managed to lose the debate anyways. How do they manage to – and this is, by the way, this is the genesis of the book. I was driving along in my car listening to the radio and they
– I hope you were listening to NPR.
And they were playing a town hall meeting somewhere. And it was a crowd of you know, in these meetings. Remember the summer of 2009?
Oh, sure.
And you would have these legislators, typically Democrats, trying to explain the health care proposal to their constituents. And the constituents that typically were very angry and were screaming and yelling. And you had some really
– saying you're taking away my Medicare.
There's a lot of confusion. Yeah. A lot of confusion, but also a lot of populist anger. And a lot of people saying, you know, what about freedom? You know, they wanted to talk about core issues like like the most – they thought that this was a threat to the most basic, you know, American – you know, the things that they valued most as Americans. And I would listen to this and it would drive me up the wall. I would get so angry, Diane, because why doesn't the senator or the congressman in question come out and say, no, this will enhance your freedom. This is what free countries do. You know, we as a free people, as a free society can come together and make sure that we have some, you know, basic elements of security here. They never did this. Never. Why don't they do it? Why don't they say these, you know, why don't they explain the stimulus program?
How do you answer your own question?
They always fall back on expertise. And this is not just the failing of Barack Obama, whom I like a lot, and of his, you know, innermost members of his cabinet. This is a failing of the Democratic Party. They aren't the party of working people anymore. I mean, they are. A lot of working people vote for them, obviously. But they think of themselves as the party of professionals and professionalism and the party of expertise. And so they do these things. And what the Democrat in those town hall meetings would typically say is the experts say this is the way to do it. They always fall back on expertise. And so we got this huge stimulus bill in 2009 that was the right thing to do. But they defend it by saying, you know, we know this is what we have to do because the economists say this is what we have to do. No, that's not how Roosevelt did it. You don't win the public over by saying economists told us to do it and therefore we're doing it.
Here's a tweet from Mark. He says, your guess suggests the right had fairly taken over radio. Hasn't the left attempted to push counterweights to Rush only to fail?
Well, I think he's referring to Air America there.
And Jim Hightower.
Yeah, and there have been all sorts of failures.
Sure.
That is a very interesting question, why that happened. I have never actually looked into the reason for that, why there's never been the liberal alternatives have failed and failed again. But I mean, it is true what he's saying. But I don't think it's just simply because, you know, Rush is right or something like that. Sorry, I laugh. I shouldn't laugh about that. But because, I mean, it's a legitimate question. But I've never looked into that. I wish I had.
All right. Let's go to Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Diane, this guest has been talking for almost 50 minutes about the cause of the financial crisis, and never once has he acknowledged the housing market, which was the character that took down the tackle. Yes, there was problems with the regulations, but the major cause, every economist will acknowledge, the major cause of the crisis was the housing market, and that wasn't because of overregulation. That was because the Clinton administration who actually pushed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Countrywide and all the other banks who were not giving out enough loans to people who had poor credit or bad credit risks. And this led to a dramatic increase in risky loans and risky loan practices. Banks were actually encouraged to take, you know, liar loans and other ways to work their way around. Well, you could look. I myself was approached by banks who are saying we don't need to have proof of income anymore.
The banks did that, but that doesn't mean that the government told them to do that. The government doesn't.
No, The government told them they had to make the loans, or they were going to be facing class action lawsuits that were based on racial percentages of.
Okay, now you're talking about this is a different. This is a different myth. This is the Community Reinvestment Act myth, and in fact, both of those. There's been a lot of research done into this. The loans that were guaranteed by – look, Fannie and Freddie were bad actors, no doubt about it. But they were, if anything, a moderating influence in the housing market. The loans that they guaranteed have actually performed well over time compared to the things handed out by, say, Countrywide or Ameriquest or some of these less savory fly-by-night mortgage lenders. The Community Reinvestment Act, which is the other sort of piece of this myth – actually was not enforced. It would have, if anything, it would have cracked down on predatory lending, and it certainly did not require banks to hand out fraudulent. I mean, it had been on the books since 1977. It did not require banks to hand out fraudulent or no-doc loans or anything like that. What it was supposed to do was encourage banks to lend in underserved neighborhoods. It outlawed redlining, in other words.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Finally, to Akron, Ohio. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks.
I love your show.
Glad.
And good morning, Mr. Frank.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I'm a progressive patriot because I believe that some of the greatest accomplishments of America have been our economic and socially progressive legislation and changes that we brought about. And the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights are themselves progressive documents, especially for that time. But I think that the initial success of the Tea Party can be attributed to the fact that conservatives have been very successful at demonizing government and saying government is the problem. But actually, I think it's corporate-dominated government.
That's exactly right.
And it was.
Not government itself.
It was Ronald Reagan who first said government is the problem.
That's right. But he was echoing, these are themes that go way, way, way back. But of course, conservatives don't really hate government. They like having police protection. They like having the U.S. Marines make sure that nobody, invades our country. They like that stuff. It's only certain branches of government, the aspects of government that protect the weak, the aspects of government that make, that make it difficult to rip people off or something like that. I'm sorry, I'm going too far here. But you see the point I'm trying to make, Diane.
So if Democrats win the 2012 election, are you going to see strength being demonstrated in another way?
I'm not sure I follow strength. You mean?
Speaking out against this kind of hard time.
The hard time swindle. I think that's up to them. I think that is something that they need to do if they're going to recover themselves. I mean, look, I'm however old I am, I'm 46 years old, and all my life I have watched these guys lose, and watch their coalition gradually come apart. Sooner or later, they have to do something to change it.
Thomas Frank, his new book, Pity the Billionaire. Good for you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ring.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.